This is Walter Cronkite. These voices are the voices of Virginians speaking on one issue, the schools and who will attend them.
Massive resistance means opposing integration by every legal, lawful means.
There's only one thing that I'm sure of. There will be no integration in Charlottesville.
We look upon our standby school as a bomb shelter, and if they press us enough, we might even have to use a tent, and we'll do that.
Integration in the South is like Christianity. It's never been tried.
Developments over this holiday weekend have put Virginia and its massive resistance to desegregation of the public schools in the center of a controversy that has shaken the South since the Supreme Court decision of May 1954. 48 hours ago, 17 Negro students were assigned to hitherto white schools in the city of Norfolk. But the school board has asked the federal court for a one-year delay before these students actually attend classes. In Arlington, five Negro students were assigned to white schools over the weekend. In Charlottesville, where another federal court decision is pending, similar assignments may be made. 3 years ago, the United States Supreme Court called for all deliberate speed in the elimination of segregation in the public schools. Since that time, 770 school districts out of 3,000 in the South have moved toward limited integration. In Virginia, the affected areas are considering postponing school openings until the Supreme Court acts on the Little Rock, Arkansas integration delay. The High Court is expected to rule on September 11th. Yesterday, Virginia's Senator Harry Byrd, who coined the term massive resistance, called for a policy of no surrender in the battle against desegregation. Senator Byrd told his listeners that we in Virginia face days of stress and strain, and the eyes of the world will be upon us. Tonight, CBS Radio presents a factual report on the school desegregation crisis, tape recorded on the spot in Virginia.
As governor, it is my responsibility, which I am prepared to carry out, to see that the laws of this state are faithfully executed.
Governor J. Lindsey Almond is the first citizen of Virginia. He was asked to outline the position of Virginia and laws passed by the Virginia General Assembly to enforce that position.
The position of Virginia with reference to the operation of its public schools is based on the well-founded contention that the Supreme Court of the United States exceeded its authority and transgressed upon the powers of the states in its decision, which reversed the long-established and universally accepted doctrine of separate but equal facilities. In substance, the laws enacted by the General Assembly of Virginia have for their design and purpose the continuation of our educational system for the benefit of both races, all of the children of Virginia. In the event a school becomes integrated in Virginia, either under federal court order or through any other means, that school automatically, under the law, is closed. It then becomes a duty of the governor to take charge of that situation and endeavor as best he may to reconcile the differences, if possible, to do anything within his power in an honest effort to reopen that school on a segregated basis. If he finds that he cannot do that, then it is within the discretion of the governor, upon the joint request of the local governing body and the school board, to return that school to the locality to be operated on an integrated basis solely with local funds. When that transpires and the school begins operation on an integrated basis, all state funds are automatically, by law, withheld from that school.
It is the duty of the Attorney General of Virginia, Albertus Harrison, to enforce policies determined by the governor and the General Assembly of the state. He explains those policies now.
Virginia's law provides that any public school in this state forced to integrate will be automatically closed, and another statute which operates to cut off state school appropriations to any locality wherein public schools are integrated. It is to be observed that the law which closes schools limits school closing to the specific school or schools involved. all other schools continue to operate. This law thereby postpones the application of the General Fund Cutoff Bill, which is more drastic and far-reaching, and which, if applied, could affect all schools within the same category as the school which is integrated.
Why did the Assembly give the governor such broad powers over the school system?
We seek to avoid the occurrence of anything in Virginia that might disturb the peace and tranquility of our cities and counties. We feel that it is better for a school to be closed temporarily and the governor of Virginia given an opportunity to investigate local conditions, possibly reorganize the school, or make some other arrangement for the education of the children in that school, rather than open the school and then have to close it because of public resentment, mob action, or the use of troops. It is becoming increasingly evident that public schools cannot operate efficiently or effectively where the tension in the schools is such as to call for the use of troops, federal marshals, or even local police. The people of Virginia feel that the matter of segregation or integration of the races in her public school system is a matter to be determined by the people, white and Negro, of this state, as was done by other states that integrated prior to the decision. Virginia is determined that she will commit no act to disturb the harmony and splendid relationship that has existed between the two races here.
There is no sign on the door of the Virginia headquarters of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. At the head of a long flight of wooden stairs is the office of W. Lester Banks, Executive Secretary of the state organization.
At the present time, there are no Negroes in the Virginia General Assembly. There are no Negroes as members of city councils in the state of Virginia. At the present time, there is one Negro who is a member of a county board of supervisors. The approximate overall Negro population for the state of Virginia is 700,000. The approximate state population is 3,318,600. That makes the Negro population roughly about 25% of the total population. In the drafting of the Massive Resistance Program, the opinions of the Negro leadership of Virginia were almost completely unsolicited.
There are those who feel the state government's program is completely justified and, most important, constitutional. Collins Denny, Jr. is a Richmond attorney.
That program is very simple. The cardinal feature of it is that we will not appropriate a penny of state monies to support an integrated school. Our current appropriation bill makes appropriation of state monies to support what we term an efficient school, and it makes appropriation of monies to no other type of school. An efficient school is defined as one in which the races are not mixed. Immediately upon the admission of a colored child into a white school or of a white child into a colored school, I have no hesitancy in expressing the opinion that it is legal and entirely constitutional.
Whether or not the people of Virginia are behind the Massive Resistance Program is a subject of controversy. Overton Jones is associate editor of the Richmond Times-Dispatch, one of the oldest and most influential papers in the South.
Massive resistance means opposing integration by every legal, lawful means. The people of Virginia, the majority, I believe, feel that the state government is right in taking the view that the Supreme Court decision is not the law of the land in the sense that it cannot be contested by legal means. There's no question about the fact that there was discrimination and prejudice and that the Negro in the South received unfair treatment for many years. But slowly, the thinking people of the South, the public-spirited people, were leading the South to overcome this prejudice and unfair discrimination, and the Negro was making tremendous progress. He was being employed in public office as policeman in many Virginia cities, many southern cities too, for that matter, and in many other ways was achieving his rights under the law. And also his schools, I might mention, were becoming equal, in many places superior, to those of the whites. But unhappily, the 1954 Supreme Court decision put the brakes on this progress that was being made. And so the net result has been a most unhappy one from the standpoint of racial relations in the South. Times-Dispatch last fall conducted a poll among its readers in 40 counties of the state's 98 counties, and 91% of the people said they favored segregation. Almost 70% said they were willing to see the schools closed if necessary to prevent integration.
Dr. John Marion, a Presbyterian clergyman and former director of the Virginia Council on Human Rights, questions the conclusions to be drawn from such a poll.
A Richmond Times-Dispatch poll some months ago was said to show that more than 90% of Virginia's white parents preferred closing the public schools to accepting any degree of desegregation. This poll may reflect accurately, and I think it does, the feelings of many white parents in some parts of Virginia. But I don't think it gives a fair picture of the real sentiment in all areas. Virginians are far from being all of one mind on this question. Arlington County, for example, is not like Prince Edward County, and the problems faced by many northern and western communities would be far less acute and troublesome than those in many Southside counties. Yet today, the Southside citizens who prefer no public schools at all to any degree of desegregation are dictating the policy of the state as a whole.
The term massive resistance was born 1 month after the 1954 Supreme Court decision. The term's full meaning has become apparent with the development over the past 4 years of legislation designed to keep the state's public schools segregated. Dr. Marion was asked about the alternatives to the present program.
Senator Byrd is widely regarded as the chief architect of the present policy of massive resistance, and many people feel that the atmosphere in the state today would be very different from what it is, and we would be much nearer a solution if a more moderate policy, a local option policy, had been adopted several years ago by the leaders of our state.
Did the people of Virginia ever have a chance for local option?
Before the massive resistance policy was adopted, a plan was drawn up by a special commission appointed by the governor, known as the Gray Commission, after the chairman of it, Senator Garland Gray. And this commission brought in a plan which was approved by the people of the state by a 2-to-1 majority in a public referendum. The Gray plan provided, among other things, for private tuition grants to parents of children who would be sent to private schools in communities that had undertaken to desegregate their public schools. It also provided for the adoption of some kind of desegregation plan by communities that wanted to go ahead and meet the Supreme Court decisions in the light of the needs and conditions in their own localities.
Only one part of the Gray plan was submitted to popular vote. That section provided for the issuance of tuition grants to pupils who would not attend integrated schools. The vote overwhelmingly favored such grants of private tuition. But the other features of the Gray plan were shelved. Even the possibility of integrated schools was no longer to be considered. Was this the reflection of public opinion? Editor Jones.
In November of last year, in our gubernatorial election, J. Lindsey Allman, Jr., the Democrat, polled 329,000 votes. And State Senator Ted Dalton, the Republican, polled 189,000, nearly 2-to-1 for the Democrat. Now, of course, this is a Democratic state, and the Republican Party does not usually fare too well. But while this last election gave Mr. Dalton about 36% of the vote, the previous election 4 years earlier, when he also ran for governor, had given him 45% of the vote. Now, the reason for that decline is generally attributed, even by Mr. Dalton, to the racial problem. He favored a plan of a local option, allowing the localities to handle this matter and thereby opening the way for some integration. Mr. Allman favored massive resistance. Mr. Dalton himself said that the use of federal troops in Little Rock had cost him many votes. And to use his exact words, "Little Rock knocked me down to nothing. It wasn't a Little Rock, it was a Big Rock."
There is an undercurrent of fear Virginia may have a Little Rock of its own. Prince Edward County, only a few weeks ago, was the focal point of the drive for integration. But a federal court judge granted a 7-year postponement to this Southern Virginia community. No such delays have been granted in Charlottesville, Norfolk, and Arlington. At the heart of the local school board's problem has been the creation of a state Pupil Placement Board. Here is Fendel R. Ellis, superintendent of schools in Charlottesville, Virginia.
An action was brought yesterday bringing the school board into state court to restrain it from assigning pupils to schools. Since there's a state pupil placement board, which, according to state law, has this responsibility. The school board of the city of Charlottesville is caught between the federal court's ruling that the schools must be desegregated by the beginning of the school term in September, and the state's policy of massive resistance, which provides that any school that is desegregated shall be closed. This poses a problem for which there appears no easy solution.
Under the state law, only the pupil placement board has the right to make student assignments. Charlottesville is a university town. Superintendent Ellis has strong feelings about the kind of community he serves.
We live in a community which has a glorious heritage of faith in public education. In 1806, our locality became the first in Virginia to support education through local taxation. The influence of Thomas Jefferson is still alive today. The university, the capstone of public education in Virginia, is located here. Two of the greatest men who have served as governor of Virginia, Colgate W. Darden, Jr. and John Stuart Battle, live here. The leaders of our community who serve on the school board and city council are men of integrity and vision. The people are enlightened. The faculties in our public schools are made up of able and dedicated teachers. It is inconceivable to me that the influence of the public schools, the institution which has made our country strong and which can keep it great, will be diminished in this place.
Now listen to another voice from Charlottesville.
I don't have too much contact with the community anymore. My activities have more or less cut me off from ordinary social activities, partly because I just don't have time for them, and partly because I feel I'm a controversial figure and it makes me kind of self-conscious. I don't really enjoy going out anymore, to tell the truth, even when I'm asked, and I'm not asked as often as I used to be.
Sarah Patton Boyle is a white woman, the wife of a professor at the University of Virginia, which has been desegregated since 1950. She's become more than a faculty wife since a national magazine published an article she wrote 3 years ago. The title of that magazine piece was "Southerners Will Like Integration." Since the appearance of her controversial article, she has become a symbol to Southern integrationists.
I think there's far more liberality in the South than anyone realizes. I think this has always been true. This has been my position from the beginning, and with all the things that have happened to me that have been personally unpleasant, I've had no reason to change my view on this particular thing. Integration in the South is like Christianity. It's never been tried.
The Charlottesville School Board has devised a plan it thinks will comply with both the federal court orders and the state laws. The man who originated the plan is City Attorney John S. Battle, Jr., son of a former Virginia governor. Battle also serves as legal counsel to the Charlottesville Board of Education.
The school board of the city of Charlottesville has been ordered by the federal courts to receive applications from Negroes to enter white schools and to act upon them before September in a non-discriminatory way. In order to comply with this mandate, and in an effort not to violate state laws on the subject, the school board recently adopted an administrative program applicable to all public school children seeking transfers into city schools. I might say that by all I mean white and Negro pupils. The program is made up of three parts. First, a geographical plan by which each elementary school serves a surrounding geographical area. Second, a testing procedure by which the proper grade level of all transfer students, white and colored alike, is determined. And third, an interviewing program by which all candidates for transfer into a school previously occupied by pupils of the opposite race along with their parents are interviewed by a group of teachers in an effort to determine the probable educational effects of granting the request for transfer. We believe this program to be legally sound in all respects. It will have a desirable screening effect and will furnish the school board with certain necessary information. It's my assumption that the school board will act in a non-discriminatory way upon the results of those interviews and upon the results of the tests. Frankly, I think that on the surface it would appear to be in conflict with the pupil placement law. But Charlottesville is in a peculiar position in that the school board of the city of Charlottesville, the defendant in this case, has been specifically ordered by the federal judge to ignore the provisions of the Pupil Placement Act and to assume the full responsibility of dealing with these applications. It follows, therefore, that the school board has no choice but to follow the direction of the federal court. If it did not, it would undoubtedly be held in contempt of court.
Despite Attorney Battle's hopefulness, late last week a state court enjoined the school board from making any student assignments. School openings in Charlottesville have been postponed until September 15th. To some parents, the outlook is bleak.
I live in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm a taxi driver. The way I look at it, I want my children to have an education. I didn't go to school here in Virginia. Well, I did grade school, but high school I went in Ohio. And, of course, we were integrated there, and we never had any trouble over racial incidents. And I got five children. I want them to get an education. And to me, it's either close the schools or integrate them, and I'd rather see them integrated. I think most people have the idea that the schools will not be closed, but to me, it boils down that they will if they don't integrate. The average person, I think, believes that the state's going to finance this private school deal, but from what I understand, that the state's going to finance part of it, and it's up to the individual to pay the rest of it. And the average person can't afford to pay tuition to send his child to school.
The Defenders of State Sovereignty and Individual Liberties is a Virginia organization to combat the desegregation decision. It is doubtless the most powerful group of its kind in the state. The Defenders are actively supporting the movement for private schools. E.J. Oglesby, professor of mathematics at the University of Virginia, is the president of the Charlottesville chapter.
Now, there's a great deal of ignorance about the matter of running private schools. Many people who've had very little experience with that sort of thing think about the exclusive, luxurious private school with costs from $1,000 to $2,000 a year. Actually, the situation is much simpler than that. It will be possible to run small day private schools, or large day private schools in our cities, well within the amount of money that will be available from the tuition grants. The tuition grant figures haven't been made public. I don't know exactly what they are, but for Charlottesville, I'd say the tuition grant would be over $200, and it's perfectly obvious that those people that are trying to scare people into voting for integration because they think they can't afford the $1,000 or the $2,000 necessary to send a kid to a private school are simply not talking about the truth at all.
We asked Mr. Oglesby what support the community would give private schools.
We had a situation here in Charlottesville recently in which a group of people representing a Venable PTA put out a questionnaire in which they asked the people whether they would prefer a measure of integration, whatever that is, or closed schools. They said they could see no other alternative. The vote on that was slightly larger in favor of integrated schools than of closed schools. A group who were not satisfied with it challenged the result and put out a different questionnaire a short time after that, in which they gave an alternative choice of the formation of private segregated schools. The people who put out the other questionnaire said that no such thing was possible. The vote on the second questionnaire came in about 10-1 in favor of the private segregated schools over the other alternatives. It's inconceivable that the people of Virginia would be fools enough to allow those public schools to stand empty when all they'd have to do would be to sell them to private corporations, and we'd then be housing our schools exactly the same place where we're housing them now.
In a ruling in 1955, the federal courts held Virginia could not operate the segregated Seashore State Park. It also held the park could not be leased to anyone who would operate it on a segregated basis. Whether this ruling applies to public schools is not known. One of the groups supported by the defenders is the Charlottesville Education Foundation.
I'm J. L. Souter. I'm chief draftsman at the United States Instrument Corporation and part-time instructor in engineering drawing at the University of Virginia Engineering School. The Charlottesville Educational Foundation was organized by a group of parents who were concerned about the education of their children in view of the fact that the schools might be closed this September in Charlottesville. We do have buildings in which children may be educated. We have an understanding with the school board that we do not hope to approach their teachers, although we have a general understanding that such positions might be available if and when the schools are closed. In connection with the facilities that might be available, we understand that several of the churches in town have offered their building space for private school groups. We deeply regret the fact that some churches seem to be having a controversy within the membership as to whether the building should or should not be available. Personally, I very much deplore the fact that that situation has developed within church groups. However, I am entirely confident that the children of Charlottesville can and will be educated in different rooms and areas around town, churches and otherwise, when the time comes.
Responsible officials in every community are concerned with the possibility of violence. In Charlottesville, the city attorney had something to say.
I feel that the situation is well in hand considering the circumstances, and if we are not bothered by outside elements, people who occupy far extreme positions on each side of the question, then there's nothing to fear in the way of lack of tranquility and harmony in the community in September.
Pro-integrationist Mrs. Boyle is also concerned.
We have all kinds of people here, as I suppose you have in every community. We have a group here that was organized by John Casper himself. We have a large group of the defenders of state sovereignty and individual liberties. We have a Human Relations Council, which is the strongest local council in the state. And we have a branch of the NAACP, which is, I think, perhaps the largest for the size town we have in the state. So both sides are very much represented here. I think, by and large, originally Charlottesville was a pretty liberal place, but I think they have gotten very much frightened by the possibility of violence and the various propaganda that's gone on about how the schools will deteriorate and the various dangers of integration. And I think that even the liberals at the present time would prefer, most of the liberals, except the extremely firm liberals, would prefer that integration would be put off a little while.
What happens in Charlottesville when the schools open is up to the government of Virginia and to the people of the community. There's a possibility some schools will be closed immediately, and there is a possibility that violence will occur. But the overwhelming majority of the city's population seek both a peaceful solution to their problem and the continuance of the education of their children. I'll be back in just 15 seconds to continue the story of Virginia Pattern for Resistance.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is Walter Cronkite again with the second part of the story of Virginia Pattern for Resistance. Slightly more than 200 miles from Charlottesville is the coastal city of Norfolk. The Norfolk City School Board is presently a defendant in a case before federal Judge Walter E. Hoffman. At first, the board refused to assign to classes any of the Negro students who applied for admission to its white schools. Superintendent of City Schools, J.J. Brubaker, gives the background.
On July 1st, 1955, the school board of the city of Norfolk passed a resolution which stated, among other things, that the board intended to uphold and abide by the laws of the land and to do everything in its power to preserve and continue an efficient system of public schools. On February 26, 1957, the school board and superintendent of schools were defendants in the federal district court and were enjoined from assigning children to schools on the basis of race or color. The judge directed that a plan for desegregation of the public schools be submitted to him by August 15, 1957. This decision was appealed by the school board, but the judge's decision was upheld by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court refused to review the decision. This was in October 1957, and the schools were organized and operating when the Supreme Court refused to review the appeal. The district judge had said he would not require the desegregation order to become effective and disrupt the schools during the school session. Hence, the schools operated on a segregated basis during the 1957-58 session. On June 7, 1958, the desegregation case was brought before the federal judge by the plaintiff, and the court ordered that all applications received from Negro children or their parents seeking enrollment in the city schools previously attended by only white children must be acted upon with reasonable promptness, and that all questions as to the rights of such children to be enrolled in any such schools must be determined by the school authorities without regard to race or color. On July 17, 1958, the school board passed a resolution to comply with the order of the court and set up standards and criteria and procedures to be used in assigning Negro pupils to schools previously attended only by white pupils, and in assigning white pupils to schools previously attended only by Negro pupils.
Most of the Negro students applying for admission to white schools live in the same neighborhood. It is an island surrounded by whites, and racial tensions here are acute. P.B. Young, Jr., the editor of the Norfolk Journal and Guide, a Negro newspaper, explains how this situation evolved.
The bulk of the applications of Negro students came from areas adjoining Norview High School, Norview Junior High School, and Norview Elementary High School. The reason for this is that there is an expanding community of Negro residents in the areas adjacent to Norview schools. In one of the areas now largely occupied by Negroes but formerly all white, the section known as Coronado, there was 4 or 5 years ago some disorder and a couple of incidents of dynamiting when Negro families moved in. Previously, many of the residents in Coronado were naval personnel. When they got orders to be transferred, they found difficulty selling their homes to other white prospects. As a result, they offered their homes for sale to Negroes. At the present and for the past year or two, there has been no disorder of any kind in the Coronado section.
The school board set up a system for testing Negro students who applied for transfer. Superintendent Brubaker outlines the plan.
The 10 criteria included the applicant's academic achievement and the academic achievement of the pupils already in the school, the health and safety of the child assigned and of the children already in the school, the effect upon the proper administration of the school and the proper instruction of the pupils already enrolled. Consideration would be given to the residence of the applicant, and consideration would be given also to the mental ability, physical and moral fitness, social adaptability, expected emotional and social adjustment, and cultural background of the applicant and the children already enrolled in the school. The procedures provided that the superintendent should inaugurate and administer a program of tests to be given promptly this year and all subsequent years. The above-described program was set up. Test results compiled, pupils' records studied, interviews with pupils and parents held, and all these data placed before the school board, which had decided by resolution to take action on each case. After the board reviewed each application, it passed a resolution on August 18, 1958, and denied transfer or initial enrollment to 151 Negro children to schools of the opposite race.
That was the official stand until 48 hours ago. Faced with federal court judge Walter Hoffman's opinion that racial tensions were not sufficient cause to deny the entry of Negro applicants, the Norfolk School Board assigned 17 Negro students to its white schools. Here is one of those students, 16-year-old Patricia Godbolt. She was asked how she would feel attending a predominantly white school.
Even if they did act as if they didn't want me there, I feel I can go with my work just the same and do just as good, because it's not really their friendship I want, it's just education. I think that people of the other race just haven't gotten to the idea that they can accept us as other human beings, but we were all created equal, and I think we should share the same opportunities as they share.
The plaintiffs in the Norfolk federal court action are Negro children and their parents. Most of them have spent weeks attending the prolonged court hearings. Here, Mrs. Elizabeth T. Branch, the mother of two teenage daughters, tells why she's doing so.
My attendance in court this week has been very tiring. I've lost time from work, but I feel it's worth it, and I'm willing to sacrifice it if it means something better for my kids. I feel that my kids are as good as any other kids, and I want them to have every advantage that this country has to offer. Father, since it is supposed to be a democratic country, and everyone is supposed to have the same opportunities. Their schools are already mixed. They have every nationality in the schools, even the Japs. And I do believe if the Russians would come over there, that they would have priority over my kids. And I don't think it's fair.
The school problem in Norfolk is more than a threat to education. School board member Francis Crenshaw describes this aspect of the dilemma at a news conference.
The situation is serious. The citizens of Norfolk, past and present, have spent millions of dollars erecting fine schools and establishing a first-rate school system. That system is now in jeopardy of being severely damaged, if not destroyed. If our schools are closed, not only our children suffer, but the entire city will be severely damaged economically. How can we expect new industry and business to come to Norfolk if we cannot guarantee all children adequate educational facilities? How can we expect good citizens and parents of Norfolk to remain here if their children cannot be educated in our public schools? The school board at present has no solution to this dilemma. We have used and we will continue to use every means at our command to handle this problem, this matter, with dignity and patience.
There is racial tension in Norfolk, but most responsible people are confident incidents can be avoided. However, there is no organized plan to deal with the situation if the schools are closed. In Northern Virginia, the outlook differs. Tuesday, the Arlington County School Board will attempt to assign five Negro pupils to white schools. Here is Ralph Call, chairman of the Arlington County Board.
The people of Arlington are very apprehensive about the school situation. We have 24,000 school children in our public school system. This is a school system on which our people have spent some $40 million building up in capital expenditures alone the schools in the past 10 years, and we have spent anywhere from $7 to over $11 million a year in the operation of the schools, and I feel, and the people feel, that we have created this wonderful school system, one of the finest in the South in the United States. And now they feel that they are caught between the ruling of the federal courts and the laws of Virginia concerning the closing of schools, and they are apprehensive that our children are not going to have schools to go to this fall.
Jack Rathbone, an Arlington plumbing contractor, is not worried about obtaining facilities for private schools.
The 10th District Educational Corporation was practically brought into being by the Arlington Chapter, Defenders of State Sovereignty and Individual Liberties. We saw the necessity for this in case our schools are closed. We have formally been incorporated as a nonprofit corporation. We have filed with the proper officials in Richmond, and we are constituted so we can borrow, rent, lease, buy properties we need for conducting a private school system in the state of Virginia. We do not look upon these things as any permanent schools at all. We look at them strictly as bomb shelters, and we want the county authorities to look at them in the same light. Education, naturally, we will have to do away with all the frills. In other words, there'll be no physical education other than the regular setting up exercises we got years ago in our school classes. We won't have the big gymnasiums and the art rooms and the science labs and things like that. We'll have to stick to the academic subjects while this standby education is going on, but we are certain that the academic subjects we teach will be as good and probably superior to some now being taught in public schools. In one of the conferences I had with the county manager, I likened our plan to a bomb shelter and wondered if he could have the bomb shelter in Arlington Courthouse come up to the same standards they were asking us to have our standby bomb shelter schools come up to. They have assembly room in the basement of the Arlington Courthouse where they huddle together about 400 people with no ventilation, no toilet requirements, no lights or anything else. That is strictly a bomb shelter, and it's a very good place for those people to go when the bombs drop. And we look upon our standby school as a bomb shelter, and if they press us enough, we might even have to use a tent, and we'll do that.
This is Mr. Call's view.
I think the 10th Educational Corporation proposal is a complete phony. The two-story residence that they proposed as a model school was in fact leased by some group that on September 1st are opening it as an athletic and recreation club. And I think that it is in no way a solution to the problems of education in Arlington County.
Two dozen white students interviewed split evenly as to whether schools should integrate.
If one goes, more are going to try to enroll, and it's just going to cause big riots.
I think it's such a good idea. I mean, eventually I think they could work it out, but they're trying to force it. They're pushing them together like that, it's not going to work. I mean, you got something that's been going on ever since this country's been here.
I don't care whether or not Negroes are in the same classroom with me. It doesn't make any difference. They're just the same people, just different color skin.
I don't really care much if colored people come to our school as long as they don't keep our schools closed, because I know I don't want to go to school in June when it's hot. Well, I just really don't care. And I know I play football, and a lot of my friends do also. And if the colored people do keep our schools closed, this will hurt our team.
In Arlington, one group is making plans to keep the schools open come what may. Old Glenn Stahl is a member of that group.
The Arlington Committee to Preserve Public Schools was established early this summer as a means for demonstrating the degree of community-wide support for the idea that, above all, we should not let this conflict over segregation versus integration interfere with the continuous operation of our public schools. The one thing above all that we stand for is to keep the public schools open come what may. That means that they should be kept open even if necessary legal action has to be taken to demonstrate the unconstitutionality of the state laws. It would not be in defiance thereof, but legal processes would be followed if it comes to that. As an organization, we cannot institute legal action, but we have already prepared a legal analysis of the situation, and if it comes to a case where plaintiffs in the form of parents whose children are being denied public schooling wish to file suit, they will find that we have some material available for them. First, we are determined to pursue every legal means to keep public schools open. Second, we are here concerned neither with perpetuating segregation in schools nor hastening integration. Three, we oppose entrusting public education to private hands having no responsibility or accountability to the general public. Four, we have faith in Arlington's ability to meet its public education problems. Five, we recognize the excellence of the teaching and administrative staff in Arlington schools. We assure them that the community values its educational system and that it is determined to maintain its public schools. We urge Arlington teachers to stand with the community in the days ahead. My impression is that the community is overwhelmingly behind the point of view for which we stand. I wouldn't say that the community is intent upon desegregation, nor do I think the small, noisy minority, the rabid segregationists, are at all representative of the community. I think the overwhelming majority of people feel that if it's necessary to keep public schools open to comply with federal court decisions allowing for some small measure of desegregation, then they're content to accept that rather than have public schools closed, even though they might prefer otherwise. On the other hand, I also feel that the overwhelming majority of people would be quite content to let things remain as they are.
Across the Potomac from Arlington, Virginia, is the capital of the United States. There, Representative Joel Broyhill of Northern Virginia's 10th Congressional District called for a direct meeting of the heads of the federal and state governments.
When a great man such as the President of the United States and a great man such as the Governor of Virginia sits down and respects the fact that there is a problem involved and will listen to each other's ideas and suggestions. Certainly no harm could come from such a meeting. And if a meeting is held like that where no harm is done, there's bound to be some good.
Last year, Little Rock, Arkansas, was one of the centers of the school desegregation crisis. It remains so today. For the latest news from Little Rock, Arkansas, here is CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore.
Governor Faubus and the Arkansas legislature have rigged up a complex series of bills and resolutions aimed at heading off renewed integration in Little Rock if the Supreme Court should order it. On the surface, the segregationists are acting as though they have found the answer, but there are evidences of uncertainty that their plan would work. The plan was to empower Governor Faubus to close any school threatened with integration, then reopen it as a private, all-white school, providing state financial support through a ruse. The original idea was to delay the opening of schools until September 15th, thus letting Virginia take the first brunt of the Supreme Court decision. This plan got a setback when the Supreme Court postponed its decision until at least September 11th. In a hasty last-minute maneuver, Governor Faubus is now thinking of permitting Central High to open on September 8th, after all, on a segregated basis. A last-minute resolution in the legislature, the last of the long series and introduced 5 minutes before adjournment on Friday, would bar transfers of students from one school to another after the term has started. This in the hope of evading integration at least for a year if the Supreme Court should order it. Although the approach is less direct, Arkansas's action adds up roughly to the same as the Virginia program, state intervention to prevent integration. But some legislators doubt that the Faubus package will stand up even in the Arkansas courts, and Faubus has not yet signed the bills which he himself asked for, apparently anxious to avoid a legal test as long as possible. Faubus has made it clear that he regards his unprecedented victory in the recent primaries as a mandate to prevent any early school integration in Little Rock. The almost unanimous endorsement of the special legislative session has apparently reinforced his determination. But whether he has found a legal method that will stand up remains to be seen. This is Daniel Shore in Little Rock, Arkansas.
This week, the fate of Virginia schools is in the balance. Virginians are not of a single mind as to the kind of schools they will be or should be. In Charlottesville and Norfolk, there is a desire, but no organized effort, to keep the schools open. Further to the north, in Arlington, there is a movement to challenge the constitutionality of the massive resistance laws, to keep the schools open at any cost. The outcome of that challenge will be determined in the courts. Virginians hope to confine the school desegregation battle to the courts. Public officials and private citizens want no repetition of Little Rock in Virginia. One thing appears certain, Virginia's pattern of resistance will set the pattern for the South. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
Massive resistance means opposing integration by every legal, lawful means.
There's only one thing that I'm sure of. There will be no integration in Charlottesville.
We look upon our standby school as a bomb shelter, and if they press us enough, we might even have to use a tent, and we'll do that.
Integration in the South is like Christianity. It's never been tried.
CBS Radio has presented Virginia, Pattern for Resistance, narrated by Walter Cronkite, produced and written by Don Kellerman and Richard Simonowski. Associate producer, Robert Young. This program has been a Unit 1 presentation of CBS News. Get the complete news first on the CBS Radio Network.